for clemency for Leonard Peltier. You can go to democracynow.org. Rigo 23, thanks so much for joining us. Rigo is a California-based political artist.
Thank
His
you.
9-foot-tall statue of Leonard Peltier is now being removed from the campus of American University, though it was originally approved. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, Rabbi Karen, Hani Massoud, Shireen Nadur, and Andre Lewis. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Triangle Productions' Forever Dusty.
Somehow, it seems the love I knew was always the most destructive kind.
Forever Dusty tells the story of how a shy Irish Catholic schoolgirl from West London transformed herself into the voice of blue-eyed soul and the face of swinging London. Dusty Springfield became the first female pop star of the 1960s with 21 hits. Again, Forever Dusty, February 2nd through the 25th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland. Coming up next, we have KBOO Evening News. This program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a public hearing has been scheduled for this evening on the proposed Kalama Methanol Refinery, the largest methanol refinery in the world.
The chairman of Portland Community College's board of directors has resigned over the decision to designate PCC as a sanctuary campus for undocumented students.
And we'll be speaking live with the Climate Action Coalition's Pat Adams about the upcoming one-day workshop.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, January 4th, 2017. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. The chairman of the Portland Community College's board of directors has resigned over the decision to designate PCC as a sanctuary campus for undocumented students. In a letter written before Christmas, Director Gene Pitts resigned in protest to that designation. The PCC board had voted to adopt the label of sanctuary campus at the urging of the student body. That decision was supported by PCC President Mark Mitzel. In his letter, Pitts said, quote, "I felt that the decision to use the term sanctuary college politicizes the college." He went on to state his concerns that it places risks on the students that receive Pell Grants and on the college's federal funding. PCC was just one of a number of Oregon colleges and universities that publicly declared that they would not help enforce federal immigration laws. The list includes Portland State, the University of Oregon, Oregon State, Lewis and Clark, and Linfield College, among others. PCC is the largest post-secondary institution in Oregon, with more than 89,000 full and part-time students.
The district attorneys for Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas counties have announced their intention to drastically cut back on the prosecution of TriMet fare evaders. Today's move by the DAs comes as the result of a Portland State University study that showed African-American riders accused of riding without paying were banned from the trains at significantly higher rates than white riders. In addition to the concerns about the apparent racial inconsistency, the prosecutors also said that the policy change was brought about by concerns that prosecuting fair cheats in the criminal justice system is excessive. The PSU study was commissioned by TriMet, which says they have concerns about racial disparity. TriMet officials say the policy change is in line with what TriMet believes to be fair, but were quick to point out that this isn't a sign that they intend to give up on fare evaders. They stated that fare evaders could still be ticketed and fined, and that riders who threaten or assault operators or other passengers can still face criminal charges.
A public hearing has been scheduled for this evening on the proposed Kalama methanol refinery. If the proposal is approved, it will result in the construction of the largest methanol refinery in the world. Columbia Riverkeeper and other environmental activists are urging the public to come out and voice their objections to the proposal or to quickly submit a written comment. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has more.
A public hearing will be held this evening on a proposed methanol refinery in Kalama, Washington. The proposal comes from Northwest Innovation Works, a subsidiary of the Chinese Academy of Sciences. By any measure, the refinery slated for construction on the banks of the Columbia River at the port of Kalama is a giant. At 320 million cubic feet of natural gas per day, it would be the world's largest gas-to-methanol refinery and use more gas than all other industry in the state of Washington combined. The massive facility would dramatically increase the region's level of methane pollution and seriously undercut the Northwest's efforts to address climate change. I recently spoke to Jasmine Zimmer-Stuckey of the Columbia Riverkeeper about the proposed terminal.
What is proposed in Kalama is the largest natural gas to methanol refinery and export terminal in the world. The facility proposes to bring in a massive amount of natural gas, refine it in Kalama into liquid methanol, and then ship it overseas to China, where it will be refined further into the end product, which is plastics. Because it is such a massive natural gas giant, it actually could shift the natural gas use of the entire region. This project has the potential to lock our region into natural gas consumption for 50 to 100 years in the future, because it could create such a demand for natural gas that we actually see more massive gas pipelines being built to supply this facility.
The same project backers had originally proposed a similar methanol refinery in Tacoma, Washington, but public outcry over dangerous pollution from methanol drove the company out of town. Kalama, less than 40 miles from downtown Portland, is the new target. In addition to the pollution problems created by the Kalama refinery, the Riverkeeper are also concerned that if the project goes ahead, it will pull along other fossil fuel infrastructure projects behind it.
It actually could shift the natural gas use of the entire region. This project has the potential to lock our region into natural gas consumption for 50 to 100 years in the future, because it could create such a demand for natural gas that we actually see more massive gas pipelines being built to supply this facility.
The public hearing will take place from 6 to 8 p.m. this evening at the Cowlitz PUD, 961 12th Avenue, Longview, Washington. Concerned citizens that cannot attend this evening's meeting are urged to submit a written comment via email. To do so, go to ColumbiaRiverkeeper.org. Go to the tab marked Our Work at the top of the page and click on Methanol. This will take you to the Kalama Methanol Refinery page. Follow the instructions in blue after the word ACT at the top of the page to submit your comments. And if you do want to submit a comment, you must act fast. The deadline for submission is end of business day tomorrow. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is clear about his New Year fears.
After misdirection, a rigged election, this unnatural selection like some massive infection, I want resolution, restitution, more solutions, less pollution. As things get strange, be an instrument of change. As the going gets bleak, keep struggling, don't be meek. Sometimes we fail or get sent to jail. That's no reason to bail. Our hearts aren't for sale. Looks like 2017 could get mean and obscene. Fight for what's right. We just might get back the light. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
President-elect Trump today used comments from WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to continue questioning the allegation that Russian hackers attempted to influence the American election. Trump tweeted, "Somebody hacked the DNC, but why do they not have hacking defense like the RNC has?" Vice President-elect Pence said Wednesday at a press conference that Trump has a healthy American skepticism about the conclusions made by the intelligence community. Last night, Sarah Palin posted on her Facebook page that important information that finally opened people's eyes to Democrat candidates and operatives would not have been exposed were it not for Julian Assange. She also apologized for condemning Assange when he published her emails in the past.
Under France's new law, all people become organ donors when they die, even if it goes against the wishes of the family. Under the old law, unless the person who died had previously expressed a clear wish for or against donation, doctors were required to consult relatives who, in almost a third of cases, refused. Those who do not want all or any of their organs to be used must now put their name on a refusal register, which 150,000 people have signed so far. Authorities have promised to make it easier for those who wish to refuse by allowing them to join the register online instead of by registered post. Those opposed to their organs being used can also leave a signed document with their next of kin or transmit their wish orally to relatives who must make a written declaration of non-consent to doctors at the time of death.
President-elect Trump has vowed to begin the process of deporting 2 million immigrants on his very first day in office and has pledged to introduce legislation that will build a wall along the border with Mexico within his first 100 days. It's been a long time since anti-Mexican rhetoric has been so heated, but this is not the first time it's been so. Lena Nosewisi reports on what history can teach us about the last time a U.S. president whipped up a similar level of public sentiment against Mexicans and U.S.-born Mexican-Americans.
Jobs are scarce, a crashed economy is unable to fully rebound, and politicians rally support by promising to send immigrants back to Mexico. That scenario may sound familiar today, but in this case, the time was in the Depression-era 1930s, and American citizens of Mexican ancestry were among the more than a million people forcibly deported or coerced to move to Mexico in the so-called repatriation movement.
Very tearful occasions. And very often, the individuals were crying. And the traditional farewell song in Mexico has been the La Golondrina, and that was frequently sung.
Francisco Ibaldarrama, a professor emeritus of history and Chicano studies at Cal State University, chronicled the mostly foreign history in Decade of Betrayal, Mexican Repatriation in the 1930s, a book he co-authored with the late professor Raymond Rodriguez.
It occurred from Alaska to Mississippi, from New York to California. Throughout the American nation, we have over 1 million Mexican nationals and American citizens of Mexican descent that are expelled out of this country. Many of the Mexican nationals had been in the United States for 15, 20, 25 years and had married Mexican Americans or also had children were Mexican Americans. Of that 1 million, generally at least 60 to 70% were U.S. citizens by birth, by being born in this country.
Balderrama says the Herbert Hoover administration promoted the deportations as a way to fight unemployment, but it was up to the cities and counties to execute the plan. In some places like Los Angeles, police conducted armed raids on entire neighborhoods and put those detained on Mexican-bound trains without due process. In other areas, Mexicans left under duress after being systematically shut out of economic life.
U.S. Steel, Southern Pacific Railroad, Ford Motor Company, major industrial outfits told their Mexican workers that they would be better off in Mexico with their own people, in their own culture.
The deportations lined up with a popular catchphrase during the Hoover administration, which was "real jobs for real Americans." The majority of the deportations took place in California. In 2003, the then Democratic state senator Joe Dunn read Balderrama's book and directed his staff to do a deep dive into documenting what happened. While the deportations were not federal law, he says it was policy. His staff found evidence that the federal government reimbursed cities and counties for their deportation-related efforts.
And Dunn says those who were expelled were invoiced for the cost of transportation back to Mexico. Dunn describes it as a small fee, but it ended up costing homeowners much more.
Well, there's a reason they did this. It wasn't as though they thought they were actually going to get the families to say, oh, okay, here's the money. No, here's what they did with it. They took that small amount, whatever it was. Obviously, it remained unpaid. And they would lien the homes.
That led to foreclosures. Dunn says some of those properties became the sites of L.A. public schools. Professor Balderrama says the mass expulsions did not spark protests or demonstrations back then, but Dunn says his staff did find documentation that at least one L.A. County official argued strongly against the deportations, saying they were unconstitutional. He got a telling written response from a supervisor.
It was like one sentence long, and it simply said to the county council from this supervisor member, this isn't about their constitutional rights. It's about the color of their skin. That memo, I'm sure that Board of Supervisor member never thought it would see the light of day. That defines it perfectly, but it was the Board of Supervisors in their own ugly way basically telling the county council to stop telling them not to do this.
At the end of his investigation, Senator Dunn authored the Apology Act for the 1930s Mexican Repatriation Program, which was signed into law 12 years ago. His efforts to pass a repatriations bill were not as successful, even though he says the bill asked for a nominal amount to be paid to survivors. Professor Christine Valenciana, whose L.A.-born mother was among the deported, says her family lost much more than cash and property.
We have one photograph of my grandmother. Which was hard to get a hold of, but we have it. We have two photographs of my grandfather. Of my mother, we have zero pictures before the age of 17 or 18. And so all we have is what my mom's been able to tell us. And that's important. She can take me to where she used to live. That's important. But they lost their home. So it's kind of sad to go there and look at this house and see, gee, my grandparents bought this. But they lost it. They were contributing members of the society, and, you know, it's sad.
Her family tree is now firmly planted in the United States, and she happens to be married to author Francisco Balderrama, whose book prompted the Apology Act for the 1930s Mexican Repatriation Program. She's conducted her own research about the Mexican repatriation. She now sees a flashback with the election of Donald Trump, who campaigned on building a wall along the Mexican border and promising mass deportations.
And so now, with what's going on, it's like, oh, I'm feeling what perhaps my grandfather felt. I can relate to the environment that existed at that time. I mean, I knew about it before, but it's different when you read about it. It's different when somebody tells you about it. And it's, but when you actually are in a situation that is very, very similar, then you feel it. You feel the terror that they may have felt. You feel the marginalization that they felt. When you have the president-elect referring to people as rapists and criminals and all these other things, those kinds of things were being said in the 1930s about Mexicans. So, you know, it's like, wow. You know, I'm not a Mexican immigrant, and you know, neither was my mom, but you start to feel it's like, wow, those people are, we're related to them.
Professor Balderrama says as he collected the oral histories of survivors of the deportations, they told him that what motivated them to talk was to prevent what happened to them from happening to anyone else. And from the beginning of his quest, Joe Dunn has wanted educators to tell the story. And while he no longer serves in the state Senate, other legislators took the baton and in 2015 passed a bill that encourages K-12 study of the Mexican-American deportations. While descendants of those affected by the repatriations may feel vindicated to finally see their family histories in classroom curricula, current events prompt the question of if the lessons from 80 years ago have truly been learned. Lena Nozizwe, FSRN, Los Angeles.
Israel stepped up illegal construction of settler homes in the occupied West Bank just 1 week after a UN Security Council resolution that condemned such activity in the area. An Israel military patrol has been deployed in the territory to protect settlers while also preventing Palestinians from reaching their own property. Israeli forces recently demolished the homes of Bedouin families in the village of Khan al-Ahmad and also destroyed 10 residential facilities in occupied East Jerusalem, leaving dozens of families homeless in the winter cold. In pre-dawn raids in several West Bank towns, Israel soldiers abducted 15 Palestinians and took them to unknown destinations. In Jerusalem, the troops abducted 8 Palestinians, 5 of whom were minors between 15 and 17 years old.
Jimmy Macaroonis, proprietor of Portland landmark Jimmy Mac's, has died. KBOO's Miriam Widman has this homage to his life and work.
The background music you're hearing is from the Mel Brown Quartet, a regular band synonymous with the Portland Jazz Club Jimmy Mac's. The club hosted its final show on New Year's Eve, and 2 days later, its well-known owner, Jimmy Macaroonis, died. He was 53 and suffered from cancer of the larynx. Macaroonis had been originally diagnosed 4 years ago, but the disease returned in November. In this interview from May of 2014 with the Oregon Music Hall of Fame, you can hear Jimmy's passion for music and for Portland, despite the trouble he has with his illness.
Portland is such a fertile music town in so many different genres. You know, you talk about bands like the Decemberists coming from Portland, right? You talk about Esperanza Spalding, a Grammy Award winner, coming from Portland, from the jazz scene.
And Jimmy's passion for music and his city was replicated in his many fans and supporters. Local jazz experts like Don Lukoff, the executive artistic director of PDX Jazz, says Jimmy Mac's has a unique place in the hearts of Portland jazz fans.
Jimmy Mac was an icon of the Portland community. He was really the anchor for the local scene because he was really the only full-time, full-service jazz club operating in Portland currently and for the last several years.
Rita Rega, host of The World of Jazz, heard just a few hours ago right here on KBOO Community Radio, agrees.
The big thing about Jimmy was the stability of the situation. He was number one, a businessman who knew what he was doing.
Back at PDX Jazz, Don Lukoff says his group is not taking a lead in finding a new location, but there are rumors that a reopening of Jimmy Mac somewhere in Portland may be in the works. And if that happens, it will be a welcome addition to the community. Other locations are already stepping up to the plate, Lukoff says.
We've seen recently the Fremont Theater come online for a venue that will be having jazz in the historic Irvington neighborhood. It's a venue that we're going to have three shows at. These were three shows that were going to be originally scheduled at Jimmy's that we've moved into this new venue. We're looking forward to bringing jazz to the inner northeast in that particular neighborhood, something we haven't done before.
Lukoff says other venues and several local hotels are either continuing as jazz venues or coming on board. But with the closing of Jimmy Mac's, the city is losing a committed music venue dedicated to jazz and jazz-inspired music. That's a shame, says Rita Rega, host of KBOO's The World of Jazz, because Jimmy Mac's was very kind to Portland musicians.
They really treated the locals really well. I mean, they created a home for all the artists that live here. You know, Portland has a pretty extensive jazz community. There are so many young players now that are in their 20s who are quite successful, and they remember the original club, and that's where they started off.
But don't worry, Rega says. The city's jazz community will remain strong.
It's not going away. I mean, jazz will continue to thrive in Portland. It's just that we're not going to have this identifiable, comfortable place.
Still, there's lots to look forward to in 2017. The PDX Jazz Festival begins February 16th and runs through the 26th. And Jimmy Mac's own Mel Brown is the festival's jazz master. You're hearing a piece from Ahmed Jamel, another favorite from the late Jimmy Macaroonis. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Miriam Widman.
Thank you.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Kitchen Conversations at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather in Portland will be sunny with a high of 35 and wind around 8 miles per hour. Hood River will be cloudy with a high of 20. Today in history, the euro debuted in 1999, uniting Europe with a common currency for the first time since Charlemagne in the 9th century. Conservative Member of Parliament William Hague said, "I described the euro as a burning building with no exits, and so it has proved for some of the countries in it."
The Climate Action Coalition is planning a day of workshops coming up next Saturday, January 14th. Here to talk about what's going on is Pat Adams. Thank you very much for coming in, Pat.
Thanks for the opportunity.
So, first of all, tell us, how did you personally get involved in the issue? Was there a specific event that pushed you into taking action?
Well, I was asked to conduct a peacekeeping workshop at the event. I've been involved as a peacekeeper in Portland since the Occupy days. And I love how this group has come together to serve the community of people who want to take action, who really want to make a difference.
So tell us now about the event that's coming up most immediately. Why are you launching this event now? And do you have other events in the future that are already planned?
Well, we see a spike in the number of folks who have decided that some action is necessary. Necessary now, necessary at this time. And organizations that have been supporting direct action for months, even years and decades, welcome these people. And they want them to be both safe and effective in the actions that they choose. This workshop on the 14th here will be the first in of many where people can come and learn about direct action and receive skill training.
And the future workshops will follow the same format as the one that's coming up here immediately?
That's our plan.
Okay. The weekend of trains is billed as pretty deep. Can you tell us by listing what the workshop topics will be and maybe who will be leading them?
Well, we have a full day, and I can tell you about the workshops. I can't tell you at this time who's leading them. But we'll have a workshop on nonviolent direct action, one on Know Your Rights, on legal observing, on peacekeeping, of course, traditional media, digital security, community safety, jail support, and legal support, and organizing 101, tabling, petitioning, leafleting, and canvassing.
Yeah, just as an aside, can you go into a little more detail on peacekeeping as a concept as it relates to the workshop and to what the coalition does?
Well, the key to this direct action is nonviolence, and the Peacekeeping Act part of it is where we have people understand just what it is to be peaceful and how to keep themselves in a compassionate state for everyone who's involved in any direct action.
So it's a personal skill set then.
It's very much a personal skill set.
Can you tell us some of the organizations that will be working with you on the upcoming workshop?
Yeah, just a few are, the Climate Action Coalition, Portland's Resistance, Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Healthcare for All Oregon.
And who is the target audience for the workshop? Who would you like to see attend the events?
Well, certainly all are invited. But especially if you are new to direct action, this workshop is for you. You can find out how to help in the ways that work for you and that also put your talents to the best use.
Would it be your hope then that people take the skills they learn in the workshop and go out and channel them into a productive future?
Exactly. This is the beginning, and it's a foundation that you'll be able to use whenever you go out in direct action.
So it's not specific to any particular topic. It really is a general skill set that you could use for any type of action going forward.
Right. Not any specific event, action, or organization.
Is there any kind of hotspot in the workshop lineup that that you are personally really excited about?
Well, you know, while the media representation of direct action can be pretty simplistic, the real process is both pointed and subtle. It's immediate and painstakingly strategic. To just become aware of the beautiful fabric of support that's available to those who are willing to act. To find that I am supported in so many ways by so many committed, brilliant people. This is what excites me about our event.
Was some of the topics that you're going to be covering in the workshop, were these skills or areas of knowledge that you came into the coalition with already, or did you learn them after you got involved?
Well, I hope that I'm learning every day. And I had mostly, when I began, I mostly had an interest. Mm-hmm. And I've since gained skills.
But it's a progressive and evolving knowledge?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I guess the key is to keep an open mind when you enter something like this, and don't assume that you already know the score.
Right, right. And also always to be gentle with yourself when you find out that what I thought I knew wasn't maybe true.
The workshop spans racial justice, climate action, immigrant rights, and other topics. Is there a thread of commonality that you see between all of those topics?
Well, we can't possibly cover all these issues in depth. What we can do is offer the basic skills that all nonviolent action depends on for safety and effectiveness. There are ways to come together that build relationships, that build the movement in powerful ways.
Give me an example.
Well, going back to the peacekeeping.
Sure.
Every interaction that happens as we go along, we can use these peacekeeping skills not only when we go out to do an event, but also as we work together to build a coalition.
Do you find that using these skills makes people who are maybe not directly opposed to your message, but who are maybe a neutral party or an uninformed party, does it make them more receptive to the message that you're trying to convey?
Well, I certainly would hope so. But in my experience, the biggest change happens in me.
Mm-hmm. So by changing yourself and adopting these techniques, you kind of set yourself up as an example to people that they will hopefully want to emulate.
Exactly.
Moving forward into the upcoming Trump administration, what do you think that we should really be keeping our eyes on?
Well, I don't think we should be keeping our eyes on Donald Trump. I think we should be keeping our eyes on each other, looking for ways to come together to champion social justice, to focus our energies and our messages in ways that work for the justice we seek.
Mm-hmm. If are there any, just on a personal note, are there any particular areas that you feel are really danger points with this upcoming administration that folks should be aware of?
Well, in my opinion, we are going to get what I would say are a lot of red herrings, a lot of things that get thrown up that are easy to react to and that will distract us.
That's interesting to say that, because we certainly saw that during the election, so the whole run-up to the election, where substantive issues were thrown by the wayside in favor of splashy talking points, little micro scandals. So you anticipate that that will continue on for at least the next 4 years?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So this is a way to focus our energies in a way that really set all those red herrings aside.
You know, that's interesting. Do you think that an outcome of some of the skills learned in the workshop will be the ability to self-filter so that you can ignore the chaff and really concentrate on the wheat?
Yes, and also I think the red herrings that come out, they tend to isolate us, and they tend to make me think, oh, I'm going to react to that. And what instead we have here is we have our strength in coming together. And so it's not to look to Donald Trump and not to look to the politics to find out what's happening and what to do. It's to look to each other.
That's actually really interesting that you say that. So in other words, then the trick is to to not react to what is being done, say in this case by the Trump administration, or you know, maybe a corporation, or maybe a state or local government, but rather to take your own actions in your own directions to steer the agenda personally, so that you don't get caught up in their whole business.
Exactly, exactly, and it makes getting up in the morning much nicer.
I hope so. Is there a place online where people can sign up or find out more information about the workshops?
Yes, there's a Facebook page, the Stand Together, a Day of Action Workshops. And there you can register and give us an indication of which workshops that you would like to attend so that we can make sure we have room for you and we have an idea of how many people are coming.
That was Day of Action?
Day of Action. Yes, sir.
And there'll be a listing on there of the topics to be covered in the workshop?
Yeah, actually, it's within the registration. So we're going to ask you to just tell us if you're coming and then also ask you which workshops you're interested in so that in our planning, we'll be able to make sure that we have enough to cover.
Are there size limits for some of the workshops, or are you just going to take everyone who wants to attend?
Well, I'm going to say we're going to take everyone who wants to attend, but there are physical constraints in the number of rooms. But we have large rooms, we have smaller rooms, so we'll be able to adjust based on the interest.
So in other words, don't delay, folks. Go on the Facebook page, see what's being offered, and RSVP for them.
Thank you, yes.
So tell us one more time, why is the event called Stand Together?
Well, it's Stand Together because that's how we make change. Because that's how we stay strong for the long haul. And really, because that's what works.
And I don't know, even know if we asked this before. What time on Saturday is this happening, and where will it physically be located?
Yeah, so this is the Day of Action Workshops. It's Saturday, January 14th. The doors are open at 9:30. Sessions run from 10 until 5 p.m. It's being held at the Sunnyside Community House. That's 3520 Southeast Yamhill, 97214. Please bring a sack lunch. It's free.
Is this the first workshop that you've put on, or is this just one more in a continuing series of workshops?
Well, there's certainly been a lot of workshops that have been put on by these different organizations, but I think this is the first one where they've all come together and said, what are our common needs? How can we all help each other?
Interesting. So this one is a more collaborative effort than the ones in the past?
Absolutely.
I suppose that's kind of the key to staying sane over the next 4 years.
Yes. Yes.
Well, I'd like to thank you so much for coming in, Pat, and best of luck for this Saturday. Next Saturday. Hopefully by then the weather will have cleared up and folks won't have a hard time getting to it. And do come back the next time you hold these workshops, because we'd love to hear how this one went and what you're taking away from it for your future ones.
Okay, that's a deal.
All right. All right. This has been Pat Adams. You can find out more about the Stand Together Day of Action Workshops on the Facebook page. What was the Facebook page again?
Stand Together, a Day of Action Workshops.
There you are. Thank you very much, Pat.
Thank you.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Khalid Mosley, Charity Marchand, and Ray Bodwell. The producer is Lisa Loving. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett.
Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. Brian's got the lowdown.
Ah, yes, I do now. All right, coming up tomorrow on KBOO at 7 o'clock, We'll have Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Voices from the Edge with Joanne Hardesty. Joanne will be taking a look at the proposal to combine the Portland Police Bureau with the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. At 9, it's Press Watch, your weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program hosted by Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, Parafoggering welcomes back Dr. Zahair Wahab to discuss his work in his home country of Afghanistan. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, your daily news magazine. At 11, Between the Covers presents Solmaz Sharif's astonishing first book called Look. And at 11:30, Black Book Talk brings you Pulitzer Prize-winning author Isabel Wilkerson, fresh off an appearance on Meet the Press, to talk about her book, The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one right now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on the Donate button.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.
I'm Lisa Loving, and this is News from the Boo. I am the outgoing KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director, and I wanted to introduce you tonight to the new KBOO Evening News Director, Charity Marchand. Charity, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
When did you start?
Well, formally, it's not happening until the 9th, but I've been here since Monday just absorbing and observing and enjoying, and yeah, I'm excited to get with it.
Charity, I have to say that over the past year that I've had this job, which has been an amazing year, I've looked all over North America, actually, for another community radio station that does a one-hour news broadcast, and I have not found one. What made you decide you wanted to have this job?
Well, you see, Lisa, I had a dream as a child, and that was to be Tom Brokaw. And for a while, I didn't think it was going to pan out, but I kept with it. I believe that everybody deserves access to accurate, objective communication, and everyone's voice deserves to be heard. And no matter where my life has taken me, I've tried to keep that focus. I believe strongly in that and have a strong sense of personal justice about that. So when a friend of mine let me know about this opening at KBOO, I decided I just had to jump at the chance and offered myself as either a resource or somebody that could really help produce news that the people deserve to hear.
There's quite a few things in what you just said that I want to touch on, but let's talk about you some more. I know you're an arts journalist and you do have a performance background.
I do.
Talk about your vision for what you would like to be doing in the department. What'd you say in the job interview, Charity?
What I say in the job interview? That was a process. It also happened during the snowstorms. That was fun. As far as my arts journalism background, I feel just as strongly about it as I do about communications. I feel like it goes hand in hand. There's a real lack of funding and infrastructure for arts here in North America and many other places in the world. And it's directly linked to a people's health and well-being. We need all these things. We need the ability to communicate and make informed decisions, and we need arts. We need arts to process. We need arts to sound off. We need the arts to represent our communities. And coming to this position, I always try and keep in mind how important that is, that that is the reason why that I'm here and that we're here. And I believe I'm strong enough to do that and to adapt and include all the multiple intelligences. And so that's what I try to do with each person I meet.
So we just innovated the way we do citizen journalism trainings here. And we have another one coming up. We have free trainings all week long, all the time. But now we're having super trainings on weekends so that people can come in. And I believe there's another one coming up this weekend. I'll get to that in a minute. But can you talk a little bit about your take on citizen journalism and who, as you're coming in and you're sitting in the Star Trek Enterprise chair there in the newsroom, who do you want to have come in? Who do you hope comes to be a KBOO volunteer? Because this is all volunteer run broadcast.
I hope all the people come. I know it's not for everybody, but I definitely feel like that recently with current events, people are feeling that they need to do something and be active. And I hope that they know that KBOO is a place where you can do that and to not worry about whether or not you have the skill set. There are people that are here to support you to help you discover that. And I feel like that's a big life lesson for almost anything. Don't worry about the end point. Don't end game like that. If you have a sincere desire or a curiosity or just plain want to be a part of the process, a part of where history is going, even if it's in your own backyard, then just take the first step. Because it's not about knowing everything on the front end. That's really not how life works. Just take the first step and then learn something new. The magic only happens outside of your comfort zone. And don't worry about how anybody's going to judge you or look at you. You know, we don't need to worry about the haters right now. We need just to get in. So,
I am interested in your professional background, your media background, because I think you got a lot going on there. Can you talk about that? I mean, for people who are listening right now, our members, the people who are big time news fans, sure. We want to invite you into our homes because that's what radio does. It right. brings everyone into everyone's living room. So tell us more about your professional background and your media background.
Sure. Well, as you can imagine, things have just flown in and out of each other. It's been sort of fluid experience. I do have a really strong arts background going back from when I was really small and started doing Hawaiian dancing, different forms that we had a family we were really close with. And that was actually my first experience. And then went into actually classical music. The whole time I was writing and somehow imagined in my child brain that I would go on to be Tom Brokaw's successor and that my arts and multicultural background would support me as I was reporting about all these different cultures. Obviously, I'm not Tom Brokaw's successor, but do look up to him and other reporters and have kept that in mind going forward and never let go of that media